Tentor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Less Heat, More Light, a guided tour of weather, climate, and climate change by John D. Aber. Narrated by David Stifel. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface. I have always been a climate geek. This may sound strange for a boy who grew up in a place some would say has no climate. As a child in Los Angeles, I was always wishing for more rain, more storms, more weather. The one time it did snow at our house, I was outside in a flash, making a snowball that was stored in the freezer until it evaporated, sublimation being the technical term. In an area averaging less than 14 inches, 35 centimeters, of rain a year, and often receiving much less, I put a rain gauge in the backyard and kept wishing for something besides spiders to fall into it. Had there been a meteorological major in the college I attended, that would have been my choice, but liberal arts colleges aren't known for their applied fields of study. Still, as my career in environmental science has unfolded, climate and weather have always been a part of my research and teaching, and a never-ending source of fascination and intellectual challenge. Every semester, I have taught classes that included updates in how we measure, study, understand, and predict both weather, with a time frame of hours to days, and climate, years to centuries. In the 21st century, immersion in weather information has become commonplace. Is there any other topic in daily conversation for which we have instant access to such amazingly detailed images, driven by a process that ingests such huge amounts of data instantaneously? I suppose the stock markets also provide instant access to large amounts of timely information, but the weather community also makes predictions days into the future. With stocks, those predictions are left to the pundits. How this access to weather data has changed. As a 10-year-old with such a strong interest in weather, I received from my parents a subscription to the daily weather maps printed by the U.S. Weather Service. These arrived by mail 3 days after the fact. As a young professor at the University of Virginia, my department was privileged to have access to huge, high-resolution, hard-copy maps of current conditions from the Weather Service that were printed every few hours. When the Weather Service started broadcasting a live show with current information and maps, that was truly compelling and educational as well. It is hardly worth mentioning how primitive all of this seems now, compared with the instantaneous radar and visible images available in real time on every web-based device from governmental and commercial sources. Yes, we now have unprecedented access to timely information from all parts of the complex three-dimensional climate system and a thorough understanding of the basic physics that drive weather and climate. And yet our ability to predict weather more than a few days out runs into the wall called chaos, the mathematical variety. This is just one fascinating aspect of the weather story I explore in this book. But what about climate change? If we can't predict the weather in the near future, how can we possibly predict climate decades in advance? Although the proposition sounds logical, weather and climate, while obeying the same relatively simple physical laws, are constrained by different variables at different scales. An example of what is called systems analysis. The same system can be controlled and best predicted or explained by different factors at different time and space scales. Sounds illogical, but that is another part of the weather and climate story I find compelling and try to present. There is not a lot of new science here. In fact, one of the central themes of this book is that we have known most of the important facts about weather and climate for a long time. The analogy of a museum with thematic rooms comes to mind, and I propose to be your guide through four of these rooms, focused on historical context, the basics of weather and climate, how environmental research is carried out and applied, and how this all relates to our changing climate system. A guide can add value to the works on display by enriching the stories apparent in the works themselves. My role here is to dovetail different parts of the weather-climate story into a single coherent canvas. More specifically, I hope to convey three central ideas. The first is that the basic science behind both weather and climate is well known and has been for decades. Although there are remaining mysteries, especially around the role of clouds, the dynamic future of ice, and the impacts on climate oscillations such as El Niño, there is more than enough known to understand the basic patterns and processes and to predict where we are headed. We also understand how we can predict changes in climate over the coming decades, even though the accuracy of weather forecasts fades rapidly more than a week or two ahead. Beyond the cold, hard facts, I also try to communicate some of the fascination I feel watching weather and climate unfold, with some basic understanding of why and how we see what we see. The second central idea is that there is a pattern and structure to how we increase our understanding of the workings of the Earth as a single, integrated system through a unique field of research now called Earth System Science. The pattern is similar whether answering the big basic questions about the history and workings of our planet, or how those answers can be applied to environmental concerns. There really are few, if any, aha or epiphanic moments in science at this level. Major questions are resolved through a long period of give and take, measurement, and synthesis. We will discover just how long the timeline can be between crazy idea, initial dismissal, extended research by many, and final resolution. I pay some special attention to the role of computer models, as they have become integral to the understanding and presentation of science, and have been a focus of my own career in science from the very beginning. Finally, all of this background and context about weather and climate, as well as how science happens, are applied to the question of climate change. The point here is that we know enough to understand where we are headed and have known that for some time. My hope is that a guided tour of the science, as presented in this book, can help foster a public discussion of climate change based on a firmer understanding of the science and support a climate debate generating less heat and more light. A note on units. Most of the countries in the world, and all of the scientific organizations and publications, use metric or SI units to express weight, kilograms, distance, meters, temperature, degrees Celsius, and other variables. The United States is essentially alone in using imperial units, pounds, miles, degrees Fahrenheit, for both public and private communications. U.S. agencies like the Weather Service, NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and NASA carry out their business in metric units, but often report publicly in imperial units. I use metric units throughout this book, but also give imperial units in a few places where the numbers will be more familiar to many listeners, or where graphics embedded in the text use that system. For temperature, F stands for degrees Fahrenheit, and C for degrees Celsius. Room 1. Weather and climate. Simple or complex? Chapter 1. Was Svante right? In what year did an early Nobel Prize-winning scientist make a first and surprisingly accurate calculation of how increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would increase global temperatures? Who was that scientist, I have used these questions at the beginning of presentations in class or to general audiences as a way to break the ice and get the conversation started. The answers are almost always a surprise. The when is 1896, and the who is Svante Arrhenius. Arrhenius will be a touchstone throughout this book, as his story captures many of the themes I present. The first is that we know a lot about weather and climate, and have known much of it for a very long time. In a book written for general audiences in 1908, Arrhenius outlined a surprising number of the basic processes affecting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and its impact on climate, including the role of burning fossil fuels. A second theme is the value of stepping outside traditional academic boundaries to address the big questions. Arrhenius's intellectual journey was a non-traditional one, even though he did win the biggest of all scientific prizes, the Nobel. The award was given for his work in physical chemistry. The interaction of carbon dioxide and climate was an intriguing sideline for him that occupied most of a year of grueling hand calculations. We will learn that many early climate calculators pursued this field as a sideline to their main careers. A third is the role of unstructured academic environments. That Arrhenius undertook his groundbreaking calculations on carbon dioxide and temperature at all can be credited in part to the innovative academic environment of the Stockholm Högskola, where he was offered his first academic position following years of traveling from lab to lab across Europe. A final theme is the importance of working with a stimulating set of colleagues from a wide range of backgrounds. When Arrhenius finally landed at the Högskola, he convened a rich assembly of inquisitive minds under the aegis of the Stockholm Physics Society. This group stimulated Arrhenius's attack on the question of carbon dioxide and climate, as well as groundbreaking work by others in meteorology, biogeochemistry, and global carbon cycling. Arrhenius's academic history, more than a century old, captures many characteristics of the modern study of climate change and its impacts. Much of the work is done in interdisciplinary labs and institutions that foster intense intellectual exchange and the constant give and take that makes the work of science both stimulating and enjoyable. Earth system science is one modern name given to the study of the Earth as an integrated system, and I feel it is not too far-fetched to call Arrhenius one of the founders of that field, in addition to his Nobel-winning work in physics and chemistry. So, more than a century later, Svante Arrhenius has inspired the creation of this book. In search of simpler ways to tell the climate change story, I read more deeply into the somewhat dismissive statements usually made about his early work on carbon dioxide and climate, and discovered a brilliant and wide-ranging intellect who was also dedicated to sharing his own very evident joy in the process and outcome of science with a broad audience. For all these reasons, Arrhenius is mentioned with some regularity throughout this book. Given that, I think that retelling his story here in a little more detail can serve as a valuable prelude to our guided tour of weather and climate. The only major biography of Arrhenius written in English is Elizabeth Crawford's Arrhenius, From Ionic Theory to the Greenhouse Effect. This brief summary of his life draws heavily on that source. Svante Arrhenius was born to a Swedish farming family in 1859. His father was not the first son in his generation, and so could not inherit the farm. As a result, the family moved to a small town near Uppsala, home to the oldest university in Sweden. One of Svante's uncles had earned a PhD at Uppsala, had established a successful career there, and is associated with the founding of its agricultural institute. Svante's uncle helped his father obtain the position of rent collector for the university, a position in which he also served for a local noble family. Sante's father was a conscientious manager who was able to leave his children a small capital bequest. Sante was tutored at home, attended local schools, and was admitted to the university at Uppsala in 1876. He was an above-average student with a facility with numbers and mathematics, always able to carry out very complicated calculations in his head. As an undergraduate, Arrhenius studied physics and chemistry, but the humanistic ideals that guided the undergraduate curriculum at Uppsala also required studies in Latin, history, geology, and botany. He completed his undergraduate work in only 4 semesters and began graduate studies at Uppsala, working with and between the programs in physics and chemistry. At this time, Uppsala and most European universities maintained a strict hierarchical structure where each discipline and department was managed by a single professor who exercised complete control over personnel, budget, and curriculum. Arrhenius's interest in both physics and chemistry displays creativity and a tendency to think across traditional disciplines that would mark his later successes, but was unlikely to be appreciated by the professors in each department. One said he had a brilliant mind, but thought him lazy and clumsy, concluding, "No doubt he has ability, if only he could show it." But revolution, at least of the academic sort, was brewing in Uppsala. Student unrest with the primitive laboratory conditions and the antiquated curriculum in the sciences led to calls for reform, to which entrenched professors offered stern resistance. Students looking for better opportunities, including Arrhenius, turned to the Institute of Physics at the Academy of Sciences in Stockholm for better facilities and a more open research environment. Another venue to be of special value to Arrhenius also emerged from this period of controversy and growth. In 1865, the Stockholm City Council set up a fund and a committee composed of 9 prominent citizens to establish an institution of higher education in the capital. As a result, the Stockholm University College, Högskola in Swedish, was chartered in 1877 and began operation in 1878 with a series of lectures on the natural sciences, open to general audiences. For quite some time, it was essentially a private, non-degree-granting institution, and was notable, among other things, for the appointment of Sofia Kovlevskaya in 1889 as chair in the mathematics department, making her only the 3rd female professor in Europe. It was also an open university, with unstructured curricula and an absence of exams and grades. Arrhenius spent a good deal of time in Stockholm from 1881 to 1883, while also pursuing a Ph.D. in chemistry through the University at Uppsala. His absence from Uppsala allowed him to focus on a research question that his primary professor in Uppsala had explicitly told him not to pursue. Arrhenius did not see chemistry and physics as distinct fields. The freer environment in Stockholm, at both the Högskola and the Academy of Sciences, allowed him to pursue the work that would eventually lead to the founding of the new combined field of physical chemistry and to the Nobel Prize. Arrhenius had hoped to earn his Ph.D. through the Högskola, feeling that the ability to grant such degrees would be approved in short order. That did not happen. The Stockholm Högskola, in its gradual transition into what is now Stockholm University, did not become a degree-granting institution until 1904, and not until 1960 did it achieve university status, becoming Sweden's 4th state university. Arrhenius produced an unusual thesis in 2 parts. The first part was a more traditional presentation of research findings on the conductivity of electrolytes in solutions. The second part was apparently something of a theoretical ramble, including 56 hypotheses or statements. This approach did not sit well with his official professors in Uppsala, and the outcome was not favorable. Rather than being awarded the highest degree possible for his work, he was given instead a fourth-class Ph.D., which effectively eliminated any chance of his continuing on at the next level in the academic hierarchy at Uppsala. Beyond that, his two major professors refused to recognize him during the very formalized process of celebrating each new Ph.D. graduate, instead donning their coats and exiting the ceremony early and in haste. One colleague present at the disputation, or thesis defense, recorded these events decades later, and said that Arrhenius's professors had decided to sacrifice him, as they considered theories and hypotheses worthless. The irony here is that the initial work that revolutionized both chemistry and physics by joining them in a new field of physical chemistry was criticized for venturing too far from the disciplinary norms of the day. His theory of the forces controlling the dissociation of electrolytes led to the Nobel Prize in 1903, and his derivation of the Arrhenius equation for the temperature dependence of chemical reactions remains a standard part of introductory chemistry classes. Both combine physical and chemical concepts. But in 1884, Svante Arrhenius was a young scientist at home in neither of the traditional disciplines of chemistry and physics, with a dismissively low grade on his thesis and no apparent future in his home country. He was described, though, as an energetic, affable, argumentative, confident young man. For Arrhenius, scientific argument was fun, and not necessarily cause for personal animosities. What I find so compelling about Arrhenius's story is that he was not cowed by his experience at Uppsala. Displaying an unusual level of confidence for one with no notable success in a traditional field, he presented his thesis and associated papers to well-known scientists across Europe. There he found appreciation and support, and the ability to share ideas with many colleagues across different fields of study and different institutions. He spent 6 years traveling among laboratories headed by leading scientists in Latvia, Germany, Austria, and Holland. It may also be both ironic and indicative that Arrhenius never did achieve the coveted status of professor at a major research university, through which he could have commanded both research and teaching agendas. In fact, at one point, he decided against accepting a second-tier professorship in chemistry in Germany, saying that he really considered himself a physicist, but also citing the superhuman diligence required of professors in that country. He questioned whether he could live up to the demands that would be put on him. But perhaps there was also a desire to avoid the highly structured and narrowly focused environment in which he would have had to work. Arrhenius's academic wandering finally ended when he secured a position not at Uppsala, but at the Stockholm Högskola in 1891. He was 32 years old and 7 years past his Ph.D. A private, non-degree-granting institution was not the natural home for a soon-to-be Nobel-winning scientist, but the freewheeling structure of this institution must have allowed and supported his wide-ranging intellect. It also provided him with his first actual laboratory for his own work. His first position at the Högskola was as a lecturer, primarily a teaching position, but his recognition outside Sweden led to a stream of aspiring students coming to Stockholm to work with him. He was eventually promoted to the position of professor of physics in the Högskola in 1895, over much opposition, but this was not the same as a position with that title at a major university like Uppsala. In 1896, he became rector of the Högskola, its most senior academic official, showing perhaps an interest in supporting and managing this unusual academic institution. In 1903, he was elected to the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, again over strong opposition. But his tenure at the Högskola was also not a long one, by university standards of the time. In 1900, he became involved in the establishment of the Nobel Prizes, and was a member of judging committees for many years. He won the prize in chemistry in 1903, and in 1905 was appointed rector of the newly established Nobel Institute for Physical Research, located in Stockholm. There, he remained until his retirement in 1927. He apparently preferred this non-traditional academic home to the possibility of traditional professorships at Swedish universities. At one point, he described the Högskola as a place where there were people he could talk to. Perhaps traditional universities would have been too isolating and limiting. One of Arrhenius's first acts in his new academic home in the Högskola in 1891 was to establish the Stockholm Physics Society. This was a fluid organization structured around biweekly meetings of leading scientists across all major disciplines, as well as others in Stockholm society who would be interested in broad-ranging, freewheeling discussions of current and non-traditional scientific topics. This new organization was in part a reflection of its time and place in Swedish history, for the 1890s was a time of elevated national pride, of creative living, and an adventurous spirit. The Högskola can be seen as one expression of this free-thinking approach, but Swedish explorers were also engaged in several dangerous and novel incursions into the Arctic world, with ambitions of reaching the North Pole. It was a time of possibilities, of escape from limited ambitions and narrow thinking. Arrhenius was a man of his times in this regard. Even before receiving the Nobel Prize, he had left behind laboratory-based research in physical chemistry, perhaps because he felt the major questions had been answered and were no longer interesting or challenging. Rather than pursuing second-order questions, or settling into a comfortable professorship and spending his later years resting on the laurels of his Nobel Prize, he remained incurably curious about science in the broadest sense and recognized no boundaries among scientific topics. So the Stockholm Physics Society encouraged and supported conversations among people with wide-ranging areas of experience and expertise that would have been hard to convene within the tightly structured setting of a major university of that time. One all-inclusive topic Arrhenius pursued with his colleagues in the society was what he termed cosmic physics. Plowing through his language on this in different sources, I realized that he was basically describing what we now call Earth system science, treating the whole Earth as an interactive system, encompassing processes in chemistry, physics, biology, and more. It may not be too far-fetched to call him a founder of Earth system science, in the modern sense of a rigorous scientific field with hypotheses based on physical principles, as well as the founder of physical chemistry. But for Arrhenius, cosmic physics went well beyond the Earth and dealt with other planets, the sun, the solar system, and just about everything else. As one definition of genius has it, he saw similarities where others would see differences. It is the intellectual hotbed of the Stockholm Physics Society that brings us to Arrhenius's work on carbon dioxide and climate. Imagine one of the biweekly meetings of the society. Some in the room had been part of the expeditions to the Arctic. The affinity for stories about ice was a natural. The idea that ice ages had covered much of Europe, including Sweden, with glaciers more than a kilometer thick, had come to be generally accepted in scientific circles, but the causes of both the onset and the retreat of such massive amounts of ice were unknown. Curiosity about ice ages in concern for the possible return of the massive ice sheets, lent some social incentive to answering the question.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?